We'll do a little bit of review and introduction, and then we'll be, once we get into the text, we'll be at the tail end of Genesis 43 is where we'll be with it. So after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot, I've talked about this many times, or generations heading. And so you have a prologue talking about the origin of the created world, and then you have 5 toledot that talk about the origins of the nations, and then you have 5 toledot that talk about the origins of Israel. And the 5 that talk about the origins of Israel, you have Terah, and then you have Ishmael, you have Isaac, and then you have Esau, and then the final section of the book is the generations of Jacob. And each of these 10 headings deal not primarily with a person who's named in the heading, but rather with the descendants, or the person or persons that are in some sense descended or derived from the one named in the headings. And so you have the generations of Jacob. It's the final section, the section we're now in. And it starts out with, so it starts out in Genesis 37:2 and goes to the end of the book. And in the first section, you have division in the family. So all the brothers are together, but they are divided, and Joseph is sold into slavery. So that's the first section. And then you have 2 parallel sections. Chapter 38, you have Judah apart from his brothers. So Judah goes away from his brothers, and you have the story of what takes place with Judah. And then you have in chapters 39 through 41, it's a little bit, or it's considerably longer, but it covers about the same period of time, and you see Joseph apart from his brothers. And there's many parallels with what takes place with Joseph apart from his brothers and what takes place with Judah apart from his brothers. And then you have in chapters 42 through 47, you have 3 journeys down to Egypt. And in the throughout the course of these 3 journeys, you find the family coming back together again. So you have the first journey by the brothers in chapter 42. You have the second journey by the brothers in 43 through 45. And the third journey, including the whole family, in 46 through 47. And then in 48 through 50, we get the passing of Jacob and Joseph, and the conclusion of the book. And then we get to Exodus. And so where we are right now is we're in the middle of the second journey. So chapter 42 relates the first of the 3 journeys. And the second journey, like the first, is structured palistrophically or in a chiasm or in a ring structure. And each of these, and I've talked in more detail in previous weeks about what those terms mean. But basically, there's 7 basic scenes in each of the first 2 journeys. So you have a journey to Egypt, you have an arrival in Egypt, you have a first audience with Joseph, and then you have the central theme. The central scene, the one in the middle, is the brothers in custody, and that takes place in both the first and the second journey. And then you have a second audience with Joseph, that's scene 5. Then they depart from Egypt, and that's scene 6. And then in scene 7, they report to Jacob. And both of each of the first 2 journeys follows this same basic pattern. And in the middle, you have the brothers in custody, and that's sort of the central, where some of the central action takes place in each of the 2 journeys. And so the last time that we were in Genesis, a few weeks ago now, we covered scenes 1 and scene 2 of the first journey. And tonight, we'll cover scenes 3 and 4, and possibly get into the 5th, or at least get started on the 5th, that is the second audience with Joseph, depending on how the time goes. So what we've covered up to this point is the journey, for the second journey, is their journey to Egypt, their arrival in Egypt, and then we're getting now into their first audience with Joseph. And that picks up in chapter 43 and verse 26. Chapter 43 of Genesis and verse 26. Any questions about the introduction before we move on? Okay. Chapter 43 and verse 26. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present, that is the brothers, which was in their hand into the house, and bowed themselves to him to the earth. And he asked them of their welfare and said, Is your father well, the old man of whom ye spake? Is he yet alive? And they answered, Thy servant our father is in good health, he is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, Is this your younger brother of whom ye spake unto me? And he said, God be gracious unto thee, my son. And so we have all of the brothers bowing down to the earth. There doesn't seem to be any clear testimony that Jacob bows down. We went into several weeks ago, now we're not going to take the time to revisit this fully, some of the complexity, whereas the first dream is clearly fulfilled. There's a little bit of fuzziness and a little bit of ambiguity about the exact nature of the second dream, but we won't take the time to dig into all of that tonight. There's something very interesting, though, in verse 27, and he asked them of their welfare. And in Hebrew, that's Vayishaal Lahem LaShalom. And if we go back to chapter 37 and verse 4, we have this. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And so the word that's translated as welfare and the word that's translated as peaceably is the same word. So before, they couldn't speak peace to him. Now he asks about their peace. So it's a neat little connection that shows we are digging back, and it's just a hint that the disunity that had reigned in their family was about to be reversed. In verse 29, you have his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. This is his only full brother, and even though he's been frantic to get Benjamin down to see him, he's insisted that he's not going to see their face until he sees Benjamin, and we're going to see if we get to the end, if we get into the next section, or actually two sections from now, that he's been willing to risk a lot to get Benjamin to come to see him, but he can't let on why. And so he has to pretend to be ignorant and disinterested. Is this Benjamin? Is this the younger brother you talked about? Oh, that's nice. You know, may the Lord bless you, Benjamin. And Joseph makes haste, and his bowels did yearn upon his brother. So verse 30, and he sought where to weep, and he entered into his chamber and wept there. And though Joseph is powerfully moved, he hides it very well. And the very lack of action in this chapter lulls us into thinking that all is now going to be well and things are going to move to a swift conclusion. So the brothers are brought into Joseph's house, and he sees Benjamin, and he goes off and he cries by himself, and you're thinking, this can't go on much longer. Joseph is asking about the peace of his brothers. They're going to be reconciled. This is going to be great. But as we are going to find out, things are about to get more complicated before they get resolved. Now, the word that's translated as bowels, in the ancient world and even in other cultures today, emotions are considered to come from the belly rather than from the heart. As it turns out, the word that's translated as bowels here actually just means compassions. It doesn't mean belly or bowels. But what happened was, in the ancient world, the word for your intestines or your inner, your belly, was so frequently used, and this is particularly the case in the New Testament, is so frequently used for compassion that entered into standard English usage as, at the time, in 1600s, as a means of talking about our deepest emotions. And so it became an English usage, so bowels became an English usage that referred to compassion, and that's why the translators rendered it that way here. Of course, in contemporary English, we use the word bowels to refer to something else, not to refer to the emotions of our... So we speak of the emotions of our heart, but that's just a different way of referring to the same thing. So there was nothing gross taking place in the passage. What's saying is that he was, literally the Hebrew is, his compassion grew warm for his brother. So he was very moved and he began to weep. Any questions or comments about this first section about his where Joseph meets Benjamin?
Do we have anyone? Just give him just a second. Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead, Laura.
Okay.
Well, he's not necessarily afraid to cry, but he's maintaining this stoic front of the Egyptian who's all powerful and who's in control of everything, and so he can't let on. So he's got this whole scheme he's about to spin on his brothers, and in order for that scheme to work, he can't let on why Benjamin is really so important to him. And so it's not so much that he's afraid to cry, as he's afraid to let the front down, afraid to reveal what's really taking place. Any other questions? That was a good question.
Yes?
Okay, let's move on. Verse 31, and he washed his face and went out and refrained himself and said, set on bread. And they set on for him by himself and for them by themselves and for the Egyptians which did eat with him by themselves. Because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one at another. And he took and sent messes unto them from before him. But Benjamin's mess was five times so much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him. So verse 31, he washed his face. This is the only place in the Old Testament where face washing is referred to. And there's one place in the New Testament where face washing is referred to. Does anyone know where that place is? There's only two verses in the whole Bible that talk about washing your face. It's not hand washing, which would be more relevant and is spoken about more. But washing your face is spoken about in two passages, one in the Old Testament, one in the New. Does anyone know what that passage is? Does anyone have their hand up?
Okay, over here.
Go ahead. No. Oh, is it where it specifically speaks about washing a face? So he does wash this. He does wash the mud out of his eyes. So that could be implied, where it's implied that he washes his face. But there's one other passage that speaks specifically about washing your face. Anyone? So Matthew 6:17. But thou, when thou fastest, anoint thy head and wash thy face, that thou appear not unto men to fast, but unto thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly. So that is free. That just was something that was interesting to me, that would only be mentioned two different places. So I'm not saying there's some, you know, mysterious connection between the two passages. It just was interesting to me that I would have thought there would be a lot more verses that mention that. And so we get to talking about the actual meal, returning to the main point of the story. And they set on for him by himself, and for them by themselves, and for the Egyptians which did eat with him by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So there's a question. You have the Hebrews, you have Joseph's brothers, and they're eating by themselves. And then you have the Egyptians, and they're eating by themselves. And then you have Joseph eating by himself. And so the question is, why doesn't Joseph eat with the other Egyptians? So he is portraying himself as an Egyptian. And so it could be Joseph's status is so exalted that he eats all by himself. It could also be that even though Joseph's status was so exalted, the Egyptians wouldn't eat with him because of the scruples that they had about this. And this is something that's well known from ancient historians, that the Egyptians were extraordinarily chauvinistic towards foreigners and wouldn't eat with anyone, wouldn't use the utensils of anyone that wasn't Egyptian, in particular of different people groups. Evidently the Hebrews, we find the same thing in the Greek historian Herodotus, that they wouldn't eat with anyone who was Greek as well. And so you have this is just a historical fact that this is the way the Egyptians were, and the ancient Egyptians were. And it's interesting, is Joseph so important that he, you know, won't eat with anyone else? Or do the Egyptians know that he's an outsider and they won't eat with him? We don't know. But at the story level, in the progression of Joseph's story over Genesis, so that's at the level of sort of the history and the Egyptian interaction with Egyptian culture. But there had been a time when Joseph's brothers ate without him, where they ate apart from him. So they sat down to eat and to drink when he was in the pit. And so when Joseph had been by himself before, they hadn't given him any food. But now, when he's apart from them, he is sending them food. So that's just an interesting one of the many, many ways in which what takes place now connects back to what took place in Genesis 37. In verse 33, and they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth, and the men marveled at one another. And what makes this so remarkable is that his brothers had four different mothers, and therefore they were very, very close in age indeed, and some of them would have been born almost inseparably from one another. And so the fact that Joseph was able to arrange them in order fills them with astonishment, because this isn't, given how close they were in age, this isn't something you could have figured out by just sort of going from the tallest to the shortest, as you sometimes can with young children. They're all adult men who were born, some of them, several of them in the same year because of the multiple mothers. And so, maybe getting the oldest and the youngest wouldn't be too hard, but getting them all exactly in the right order was truly astonishing. And that's why they're marveling at one another. And verse 34, he sent and took messes unto them from before him, but Benjamin's mess was five times so much as any of theirs. So in older English, the word mess simply meant a portion of food. This is where we get the term mess hall. So it may be a mess in there, but that's not what it means. Hopefully it's not, but, you know, One could imagine a mess hall that's messy, but it has no connection to something being messy in the sense of sloppy. It just is a portion, and that's what the Hebrew word means as well. And he gives Benjamin, the younger brother, a portion that's five times more than they had. And it wasn't simply because he was trying to fatten Benjamin up, but it was a sign of marked favor, and he was trying to see if they would be jealous of Benjamin as they had once been jealous of him. And this really becomes a passionate effort on Joseph's part, where he's willing to push the line farther and farther and farther in order to try to really test his brothers and really find out what's in their heart, even at times neglecting to examine what his own actions were revealing about his heart. And one of the times that takes place is in the second part of verse 34, and they drank and were merry with him. And the Hebrew word that is here translated as merry occurs 18 times in the Old Testament. And in all 17 other passages, I looked all of them up, It always refers to drunken inebriation. It never means anything else. So when you have Noah's drunkenness in chapter 9, it's this same word. When you have David makes Uriah drunk, it's the same word. And in the prophets, when it speaks about making people drunk so that they vomit and take their clothes off, this is the same word that you have. And so saying we're merry, that's the only place this word is translated this way. It sort of exonerates Joseph, but it assigns the word a meaning that it doesn't have anywhere else in biblical Hebrew or in any Hebrew text that we are aware of. And the normal meaning of the word the way it's used in the story of David and Uriah, the way it's used in Isaiah, the way it's used in Genesis 9, fits the context perfectly. Joseph arranges for his brothers to have a massive hangover during the episode about the silver cup. So he's, and we find this as a progressive tendency, that in his zeal to test his brother's character, Joseph seems willing to go to ever greater extremes and be ever less cautious in what he's willing to do as he's so focused on testing them. Any questions? So this brings us to the end of scene 3, which is their first interview with Joseph. Then we have scene 4, the brothers in custody, and then scene 5, the second interview with Joseph. So any questions or comments about this scene 3, their first interview with Joseph? One of the things we have to be, you know, cautious of, particularly in the narratives of Genesis and really in Hebrew narratives in general, in the Old Testament narratives in general, is there is very little editorial commentary. So there will be really quite horrific things that will take place, and the perspective of the story is implied rather than directly stated. Certainly, God uses Joseph's deception, but God also used Joseph's sale into slavery, which is clearly not condoned by the narrator. So I think, especially as we get further into the story, I think Joseph is increasingly frantic to figure out what's really in his brother's hearts, and he's giving less and less attention to the means that he's using. And I think when we get to Judah's speech, we find that implicitly Joseph himself, so not only do we see a change in Judah's character, we see that Judah's change of character confronts Joseph with a needed change in his approach, and he stops he stops his whole process of deception and testing, and finally admits who he really is, and the story moves on from there. So as we come close to that central climax of Judah's speech in chapter 44, 18 through 34, we find Joseph doing things that we would expect that really seem skirting moral lines, if not crossing them completely, and he's doing that more and more. And so I don't think that the narrator approves of what Joseph is doing, at least doesn't fully approve of it. That it's Joseph's own, what he was thinking was probably very, very conflicted. And I think that is, sometimes we think when we are right that the end justifies the means without giving much thought to the means, but often those people who end up doing the things that are really the worst actions are justified by the best end. So we will justify what we're doing because we think we're right on the whole, and so therefore it's okay for us to cross boundaries of deception, of dishonesty, that maybe we would condemn even others for doing. So I don't think Joseph's conduct in this part of the story is portrayed as something to emulate at all. Certainly his conduct in many other portions of the story is, but what he's willing to do to test his brothers, he seems to be potentially rebuked for that. And it's sometimes hard to tell. Is there someone else?
All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was having a hard time hearing you. Is there any that he was after what? So there's no statement in Scripture that makes it explicit what his intentions were, and I think in reality it's complicated, because reality is complicated, and I think the story and the way the story weaves the different elements together, where you first think one thing and then you think something different and then it reveals a third angle, reveals some of the messiness of what real life actually looks like. And so we have to pick up on hints that are given in the story. We are never explicitly given the master key that tells us this is what Joseph was thinking all along. Oh, Joseph was probably thinking lots of things. He probably had some intentions that were very good and probably struggled with some temptations that were not so good. And that's really the case, the way that life normally is. But I think some of that is going to become clearer as we move forward. And so in chapter 44 and verse 1, "And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put every man's money in his sack's mouth, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest, and his corn money. And he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken." And so Joseph has already given his brothers a hangover, and while they're recovering from that, then he tells his steward to take his silver cup and put it in Benjamin's sack. So the word that's translated as cup is an unusual word. It's not the normal word that refers to as a cup. It's a word that likely has an Egyptian origin. So it's this sort of exotic word. Maybe the English word goblet that carries this sort of idea of something special and set apart and unusual might capture some of that. But the main point isn't the unusual word for goblet, but the fact that this goblet or cup is silver. And of course, the brothers had sold Joseph for silver, and this is a word that we find traced all throughout the story of Joseph, that it keeps coming back to silver. And so the fact that the cup is made of silver is undoubtedly significant. And one commentator pointed this out. The brothers had sold Joseph into slavery for 20 pieces of silver, and now he harasses and tests them with silver. And so in verse 3, as soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away, they and their asses. And when they were gone out of the city and not yet far off, Joseph said unto his steward, Up, follow after the men. And when thou dost overtake them, say unto them, Wherefore have ye rewarded evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing. And he overtook them, and he spake unto them these same words. So, it's important to note that the men were sent away. They didn't pick their time of departure. Joseph decided when they would leave, and he sent them away at dawn. So, first they were drunk, and then they had to get up very early in the morning, as soon as the morning was light, and leave. So, Joseph is getting them as befuddled as possible. But they're leaving, and they're leaving with their donkeys. And remember, they've been very concerned about what was going to happen to their donkeys. And now they're leaving Egypt. They have corn. They've been fed. They are befuddled, but they are probably congratulating themselves on a successful trip to Egypt, that despite the weirdness of the situation, they seem to have made it out in one piece. But then we get, then just as they are finally feeling a little bit secure, the farther away they get from that really weird governor of the land, the servant runs up to them, catches up to them, and said, Wherefore have you rewarded evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? And this is what Joseph told the servant to say, but the servant doesn't mention a cup. It's like he increases the suspicion by not saying what he's talking about. You know, if you ever see this is a sort of a common theme in, you know, when, so I don't know if police actually do this, presumably they do, but in sort of, you know, detective shows, they always treat the person as if they know what they're talking about to try to elicit a confession from them. And so it's like he's saying, by omitting the word cup and just saying, this thing, it's like he's saying, you know what I'm talking about. And of course they don't know what he's talking about. And so then that makes them feel confused, which makes them act guilty, you know, which, you know, ups the pressure. Now, here's one of the things that's very interesting. He says, and whereby indeed he divineth. And so this is the same word that we find in Leviticus 19:26. Ye shall not eat anything with the blood, nor shall you use enchantment. So that's the same word that's found here, nor observe times. And so divination was a very common practice in the ancient Near East. And one of the ways in which divination took place is you'd have a cup or a bowl, and it'd be filled full of water, and you'd pour oil into the water, and depending on how many droplets the oil broke into and how those droplets moved around, they had books that would tell you how that could foretell the future. And in fact, in certain, like, the Akkadian culture, the most common book that we found from the Akkadians is books about various forms of divination, this being one of them. And so if you really are so inclined, you can dig up the records of the ancient Akkadians and learn how all of this worked. But more to the point, and more in terms of application to our own lives, in Genesis 41:16, when Joseph is brought before Pharaoh, he says this, It is not in me, God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Now, I don't think there's any indication in the passage that Joseph himself actually tried to figure out the future by using oil and water in a cup. But what there is a clear sense of is that he was willing to present himself not only to his brothers, but also in front of his servants, the Egyptians, as someone who did divination. And earlier in his life, when he had come through a period of great adversity, he made it very clear, even when he had reason to benefit otherwise, he made it very clear that God was the one who enabled him to interpret dreams, who enabled him to know what was taking place. But now we find, after several years of prosperity, that Joseph's conscience is no longer, so we talked about conscience at the beginning in the Book of the Month. And here I think we see that Joseph's conscience is not quite as sensitive to who's getting the credit and how that God is the one who tells the future, and making a clear distinction between what the pagans did and what Joseph did. That was something he had made a clear point of earlier in his life that now he's no longer scrupling about. Now, his intention to his brothers is to maintain his front as, you know, the Egyptian governor who's very much not like a Hebrew person. That's probably his intent. But whereas before he had a scruple of conscience about this, now I think his conscience has become a little bit hardened. And often, particularly when we go through seasons of prosperity or when we are given a position of authority, things that we once made conscience over, we may begin to think are no longer such a big deal, even though very often it's our sensitivity to those seemingly little things that are the essence of our testimony in the world. So that's an application question that I would have if anyone wants to answer it. How can we allow our consciences to become hardened to the little things that are the essence of our testimony to the world? Anyone?
Give it a second.
How can we allow our consciences to become hardened to the little things?
To the little things.
To the little.
Anyone?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of ways that that can take place. I know one of the things that it can easily take place in is in the realm of entertainment, that there could be forms of entertainment. Now, obviously, we can also learn that there were things that we once thought were sinful, that we you know, gain clarity from the Word of God, that we come to realize, oh, I used to think this was sinful, but now I realize that it's acceptable. But we have to realize that our consciences can become hardened as well, and there can be things that actually are sinful that we begin to think are not such a big deal. In the language that we use, in the way that we speak about God, in the things that we allow ourselves to watch, even in the things that we allow ourselves to wear, certainly our consciences can be oversensitive, but they can also become desensitized by what we see and hear all around us. And that's something to always be aware of. And I certainly think that given the clear condemnation of enchantment and divination consistently throughout the Old Testament, of it being a very big deal, that even though this came before the law, it wasn't something God thought lightly of before, since Joseph had made a big deal of it even earlier in his life. And so then, moving on to verses 7 through 10, verses 7 through 8, the brothers assert their innocence. And they said unto him, Wherefore saith my Lord these words? God forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sacks' mouths we brought again unto thee out of the land of Canaan. How then should we steal out of thy Lord's house silver or gold? So if you remember, when Joseph, you know, first was telling them that you're spies, their defense was, well, we are 10 brothers, and so therefore we're not spies. Which was really not the strongest of arguments, even though it made a certain sort of sense. But on the face of it, this is a much stronger defense, because they're saying, you know, you put silver in our sacks, and we brought it back to you all the way from Canaan, so why in the world... Why in the world would we steal a cup? And so they give their defense, and then they say this, With whomsoever of thy servants it be found, both let him die, and we also will be my Lord's bondsmen. And so they're so confident that this is a false accusation, that they say, Look, whoever this cup is found with, just kill him, and then all of us are willing to be slaves. So they learned their extreme response to accusation from their father. And so Jacob, if you recall, when Laban came and inquired about his teraphim or his household gods, he said, whoever your gods are found with, just, they're going to die. And Jacob got off with that, because Rachel hid the gods and was not found out. But now his sons, imitating what the father did earlier, they are caught out because they thought they were innocent, and they were so sure of that they were willing to make rash statements. And sometimes we can be tempted to make rash statements in defense of our own innocency or defense of the rightness of our position. And then later we find that we have trapped ourselves. In verse 10, we find the response of the servant. And he said, now also let it be according unto your words. He with whom it is found shall be my servant, and ye shall be blameless. So the servant does not accept their extreme punishment that they've suggested. Verse 11 through 13. Then they speedily took down every man his sack to the ground, and opened every man his sack. And he searched, and began at the eldest, and left at the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes and laded every man his ass and returned to the city. So the servant knew what he was doing. He starts with the oldest brother's sack. And you can imagine the brothers. I mean, they were so confident. They were so confident that they were innocent that they were willing to say, whoever you find this cup with, let them die. And so he opens Reuben's sack and there's no cup. And you can imagine them begin to breathe just a little bit of a sigh of relief. And then Simeon, and then Levi, and on the way down through the brothers, no cup, no cup, no cup, no cup. By the time he gets to brother 8 or 9, remember there's 11 of them on this trip. By the time he gets to number 8 or 9, you can imagine them sort of, you know, shaking their heads, rolling their eyes a little bit. What in the world is this servant doing? We have not taken a cup. So you can imagine them becoming more and more at ease until they get to Benjamin. And the cup was found. And they tear their clothes. Even though they don't say anything, their actions speak louder than words. Because remember, when Joseph disappeared, it was only Jacob and Reuben that rent their clothes. And the other brothers, so renting your clothes in the ancient Near East and throughout the Old Testament is a sign of extreme grief. It's what you did when your heart was broken. So Reuben was upset about Joseph being sold into slavery, and Jacob was upset about it, but the brothers really didn't care. They showed no sign of grief. But here's why this is significant. The servant had already said, only the guilty one is going to stay as a slave, and everyone else gets to go off free. And so the fact that they all voluntarily return to the city, and all of them tear their clothes, is the first sign of solidarity that included the sons of Rachel that we've seen in the story. They seem to assume that Benjamin was guilty, and they're now placed in the role of Jacob. So when Jacob is confronted with Joseph's bloody coat, he simply assumes that Joseph is dead. He doesn't ask questions. He doesn't try to think of an alternative explanation. He just is crushed by what has taken place. And now they are in the role of their father. And rather than distancing themselves from that, they begin to understand what they put their father through. And this is going to soon bear profound fruit in the life of Judah. And so they had already been told that only the guilty would be punished. And so this sign of solidarity is very significant indeed. And we'll pick up next week with scene five, their second audience with Joseph and Judah's climactic speech, which in many ways is the high point of the book of Genesis as a whole. Before we conclude, are there any final questions or comments before we wrap things up with a word of prayer? All right. Let's finish with a word of prayer. Father, I thank you for this opportunity to discuss your word with your people. I pray that you would bless it to our hearts, give us strength to be faithful to you. I pray you'd be with each member of this church during this difficult season that we are going through. I pray you'd protect those in particular that are working in on the front lines in the medical field. I pray you'd protect each of us and help us to be faithful. Help us to remain unified. And I pray, Father, Lord, you would shape us for your glory even during these difficult weeks. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.